From the Voice of America, this is Learning English Weekend. I'm Katie Weaver. Joining me in the studio is Marcia James. Good to see you, Marcia. How are you?
It's a beautiful spring weekend in D.C., so I'm feeling great.
So, what do we have on the show today?
Well, it's March Madness in the U.S., and you are going to tell us what that basketball term is all about. We also hear from Dorothy Gundy about some games that add a little fun to learning about economics. And later, Barbara Klein narrates The Exact Science of Matrimony, an American short story by O. Henry.
Thanks, Marcia. But first, we turn to world news. Belgian officials said three people have been detained in a counterterrorism operation in Brussels. The operation was in answer to the arrest on Thursday of a Frenchman in the Paris area suspected of planning a new attack. In a statement Friday, the Belgian prosecutor's office confirmed that Friday's arrests happened in three areas of the capital. Two of the three suspects were wounded in the leg. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with the Belgian Prime Minister on Friday to support Belgium after terrorist attacks there killed dozens and wounded hundreds this week. Kerry spoke in English, French, and Flemish, saying, "We are Brussels." A similar expression was used after attacks in Paris to show support for the victims. Kerry said, "We will not be intimidated. We will not be deterred by terrorists." He said the international community will work until it has eliminated your cowardice from the face of the earth. More than 30 people were killed and 260 wounded in the attacks. The Islamic State terrorist group has claimed responsibility. On Friday, officials said two Dutch citizens living in New York City were among the dead. The two, Alexander and Sasha Pinkowski, were killed when a bomb exploded at the Brussels airport. Two Americans, Justin Schultz and his wife Stephanie from Kentucky, have not been heard from since the attacks, reported NBC News. Belgian federal prosecutors say six suspects have been detained. They continue to investigate the Belgian and Paris attacks. They said they believe the militants lived in Brussels. Netherlands Interior Minister Ronald Plasterk said, "Everybody feels the attack on Belgium was an attack on Europe and the values we stand for together. Europe has been under attack before, but we've always defended liberty and democracy, and we will do that together." I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Kurdish reports say the Islamic State terrorist group is using children as suicide bombers. Dan Friedel has more.
A Kurdish commander in Iraq says the Islamic State terror group recruits children as young as 8 years old to carry out suicide attacks. Sirwan Barzani is the commander of the Kurdish Peshmerga fighters in Iraq. He says IS is teaching children about suicide attacks at a training center in the Iraqi city of Mosul.
They starting the training with 8 years old to 18 years old, the teenagers, the kids, how to kill the people, how to do the suicide.
Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, has been under IS control for 2 years. Experts say the children likely belong to families captured by IS. One Kurdish Peshmerga counterterrorism official says by the time these children are 12 or 13 years old, they are trained killers. He also says the same tactics are used in Syria. The Quilliam Foundation is a research group based in London. It studies methods to combat terrorism. It says children under IS control are trained to be spies, soldiers, and suicide bombers. The organization says children are turned into IS fighters through a long process. They are taken from their families. They are given no choice but to become soldiers, reportedly through beatings and torture. Last year, the United Nations estimated that the Islamic State group seized over 800 Iraqi children from the area around Mosul. The UN said the children were taken to training camps and religious education camps. Quilliam says the only way to fight the IS tactics is to start a program of re-education and de-radicalization for children. I'm Dan Friedel.
Iran recently launched two ballistic missiles off the coast of Oman. Now it has defended that action in a letter to the United Nations. Jim Dressbach reports.
Iran launched two missiles March 9th. The rockets hit targets off of Iran's coast into the Sea of Oman, state media and Iran's news agency reported. The United States and France criticized the launches. UN Security Council Resolution 2231 bans Iran from testing ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads. Gholam Ali Khosrou, Iran's United Nations ambassador, wrote to the UN on March 23rd that Iran did not violate the resolution. Khosrou said there is no basis for raising the issue with the UN Security Council in the letter. Council members met March 14th at the request of the U.S. to discuss the missile launch. Samantha Power, United States Ambassador to the United Nations, called the launches dangerous, destabilizing, and provocative, and undermine the prospect for peace in the Middle East. Iran continues to insist its nuclear activities are for peaceful purposes, according to multiple media organizations. Some members of the U.S. Congress have asked for more sanctions against Iran. I'm Jim Dressbach.
American basketball fans are in their element this month. The NCAA championship is taking place. Katie Weaver explains what that is and why it is called March Madness.
These days, you may hear people in the United States talking about March Madness. But what does that mean? Does the month of March make people angry? No, of course not. March Madness refers to a college basketball tournament. The competition takes place every March And the madness it creates is excitement. Sometimes mad is defined as angry. But here is another definition of the word: marked by intense and unpredictable activity. The 3-week-long college basketball tournament is exactly that. It involves 64 men's teams and 64 women's teams from colleges and universities around the country. Another reason for the madness is that people bet a lot of money on the games. In 2015, the American Gaming Association said about $9 billion is bet on the tournament. That is more than double the amount bet for the Professional American Football Championship, known as the Super Bowl. All that money is enough to drive someone crazy. The National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, puts on the basketball tournament. The competition is made up of 3 divisions. The men's Division I tournament is the most popular. It features players who sometimes move on to professional careers in the National Basketball Association, or NBA, and other leagues around the world. Some of the players who became famous in the NCAA tournament and now have major professional careers are Carmelo Anthony of the New York Knicks and Dwayne Wade of the Miami Heat. Retired NBA legends Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Patrick Ewing, and Michael Jordan all played in the NCAA tournament. Even tournament players who do not go pro sometimes become folk heroes for the fans that support their teams. Paul Jesperson of the University of Northern Iowa is an example. He will be famous in his state forever as a result of his game-winning score in the tournament just a few days ago. Jesperson threw the ball from half court with less than 2 seconds left in play. The crowd went wild when the ball went in the basket. The games are usually exciting, adding to the madness. Even the players are big fans. Daniel Oshefu plays for Villanova. His family is from Nigeria, and he lived there for a couple of years when he was a teenager. He says great things happen in March.
I know I was up late watching the Northern Iowa half-court buzzer beater and the St. Joe's game, you know. And so it was just, it's March, great things happen, and, you know, we just don't want to miss them. So, you know, the TV's right there, we're laying in bed, and we just turn the TV on, and something great could happen.
Of course, when great things happen, that is when the madness ends. Students in a Virginia middle school can join an economics club with high school students as their teachers. Dorothy Gundy has more.
Today what we have planned for you guys is money markets and then playing a game called Mr. Big Shot. So we'll start off today.
Just outside Washington, D.C., children with an interest in economics now have a place to learn about it. They can join a club called Edunomics. The group meets once a week at Farmwell Station Middle School in Ashburn, Virginia. Edunomics was the idea of 2 high school students who once studied at the middle school. Sahit Malayala and Sahil Yadula visit Farmwell Station once a week to teach economics to interested students. The high school seniors began studying economics in high school. The 2 say they work with the children not for credit, but to give back to the local community. Neighbors and childhood friends took their idea for Edunomics to David Stevenson, who teaches at the Farmwell Station Middle School.
I am deeply touched. I usually get visitors to come back and see me and say hi. I have never had students come back and say, this is what I want to do. And I thought it was a fantastic idea.
Stevenson helped the high schoolers find a space to hold the weekly classes. Yadula says he also showed them how to be good teachers.
Mr. Stevenson's help cannot be put in words. He helped us so much with this club. I remember after the first lesson, he was like, maybe just try to slow it down a bit, just ease into it.
Malayala says simplifying economics, financing, and business, and making it fun, is the secret to getting younger students interested.
Each week we would have a 5 to 10 minute lecture on a new topic, and then after that we would really hit hard on making sure they understood it through an interactive game.
These games help demonstrate the real-world uses of the economic theories. Club member Anika Kumar finds studying economics fun and useful.
If you want to start your business, then you need to know all about economics and money.
I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Finally, it is time for our weekly American story. Here is Barbara Klein with the O. Henry classic, The Exact Science of Matrimony.
Jeff Peters and Andy Tucker could never be trusted. One day, the two men decided to open a marriage business to make some quick and easy money. The first thing they did was to write an advertisement to be published in newspapers. Their advertisement read like this: "A charming widow, beautiful and home-loving, would like to remarry. She is only 32 years old. She has $3,000 in cash and owns valuable property in the country. She would like a poor man with a loving heart. No objection to an older man or to one who is not good-looking. But he needs to be faithful and true, can take care of property, and invest money with good judgment. Give address with details about yourself. Signed, Lonely, care of Peters and Tucker, agents, Cairo, Illinois." When they finished writing the ad, Jeff Peters said to Andy Tucker, "So far, so good. And now, where is the lady?" Andy gave Jeff an unhappy look. "What does a marriage advertisement have to do with a lady?" he asked. "Now listen," Jeff answered. "You know my rule, Andy. In all illegal activities, we must obey the law in every detail. Something offered for sale must exist. It must be seen. You must be able to produce it. That is how I have kept out of trouble with the police. Now, for this business to work, we must be able to produce a charming widow, with or without the beauty, as advertised." "Well," said Andy, after thinking it over, "it might be better if the United States Post Office should decide to investigate our marriage agency. But where can you hope to find a widow who would waste her time on a marriage proposal that has no marriage in it?" Jeff said that he knew just such a woman. "An old friend of mine, Zeke Trotter," he said, "used to work in a tent show. He made his wife a widow by drinking too much of the wrong kind of alcohol. I used to stop at their house often. I think we can get her to work with us." Mrs. Zeke Trotter lived in a small town not far away. Jeff Peters went out to see her. She was not beautiful and not so young, but she seemed all right to Jeff. "Is this an honest deal you're putting on, Mr. Peters?" she asked when he told her what he wanted. "Mrs. Trotter," said Jeff, 3,000 men will seek to marry you to get your money and property. What are they prepared to give in exchange? Nothing. Nothing but the bones of a lazy, dishonest, good-for-nothing fortune seeker. We will teach them something. This will be a great moral campaign. Does that satisfy you?
It does, Mr. Peters, she said. But what will my duties be? Do I have to personally reject these 3,000 good-for-nothings you speak of? Or can I throw them out in bunches?
Jeff explained that her job would be easy. She would live in a quiet hotel and have no work to do. He and Andy would take care of all letters and the business end of the plot. But he warned her that some of the men might come to see her in person. Then she would have to meet them face to face and reject them. She would be paid $25 a week and hotel costs.
"Give me 5 minutes to get ready," Mrs. Trotter said. "Then you can start paying me."
So Jeff took her to the city and put her in a hotel far enough from Jeff and Andy's place to cause no suspicion. Jeff Peters and Andy Tucker were now ready to catch a few fish on the hook. They placed their advertisement in newspapers across the country. They put $2,000 in a bank in Mrs. Trotter's name. They gave her the bank book to show if anyone questioned the honesty of their marriage agency. They were sure that Mrs. Trotter could be trusted and that it was safe to leave the money in her name. Their ad in the newspapers started a flood of letters, more than 100 a day. Jeff and Andy worked 12 hours a day answering them. Most of the men wrote that they had lost their jobs. The world misunderstood them. But they were full of love and other good qualities. Jeff and Andy answered every letter with high praise for the writer. They asked the men to send a photograph and more details. And they told them to include $2 to cover the cost of giving the second letter to the charming widow. Almost all the men sent in the $2 requested. It seemed to be an easy business. Still, Andy and Jeff often spoke about the trouble of cutting open envelopes and taking the money out. A few of the men came in person. Jeff and Andy sent them to Mrs. Trotter, and she did the rest. Soon, Jeff and Andy were receiving about $200 a day. One day, a federal postal inspector came by. But Jeff satisfied him that they were not breaking the law. After about 3 months, Jeff and Andy had collected more than $5,000, and they decided it was time to stop. Some people were beginning to question their honesty. And Mrs. Trotter seemed to have grown tired of her job. Too many men had come to see her, and she did not like that. Jeff went to Mrs. Trotter's hotel to pay her what she was owed and to say goodbye. He also wanted her to repay the $2,000 that was put into her bank account. When Jeff walked into the room, she was crying, like a child who did not want to go to school. "Now, now," he said. "What's it all about? Somebody hurt you? Are you getting homesick?"
"No, Mr. Peters," she said. "I'll tell you. You were always a good friend of my husband, Zeke. Mr. Peters, I am in love. I just love a man so hard, I can't bear not to get him. He's just the kind I've always had in mind."
"Then take him," said Jeff. "Does he feel the same way about you?"
"He does," Mrs. Trotter answered. "But there's a problem. He is one of the men who've been coming to see me in answer to your advertisement. And he will not marry me unless I give him the $2,000. His name is William Wilkinson."
Jeff felt sorry for her. He said he would be glad to let her give the $2,000 to Mr. Wilkinson so that she could be happy. But he said he had to talk to his partner about it. Jeff returned to his hotel and discussed it with Andy.
"I was expecting something like this," Andy said. "You can't trust a woman to stick with you in any plan that involves her emotions."
Jeff said it was a sad thing to think that they were the cause of the breaking of a woman's heart. Andy agreed with him.
"I'll tell you what I'm willing to do," said Andy. "Jeff, you have always been a man of a soft and generous heart. Perhaps I've been too hard and worldly and suspicious. For once, I will meet you halfway. Go to Mrs. Trotter. Tell her to take the $2,000 out of the bank and give it to this Wilkinson fellow and be happy."
Jeff shook Andy's hand for a long time. Then he went back to Mrs. Trotter. She cried as hard for joy as she had done for sorrow. Two days later, Jeff and Andy prepared to leave town.
"Wouldn't you like to go meet Mrs. Trotter once before we leave?" Jeff asked Andy. "She'd like to express her thanks to you." "Why, I guess not," Andy said. "I think we should hurry and catch the train."
Jeff was putting all the money they had received in a belt he tied around his body. Then Andy took a large amount of money out of his pocket and asked Jeff to put it together with the other money.
"What's this?" Jeff asked. "It's Mrs. Trotter's $2,000, said Andy. "How do you come to have it?" Jeff asked. "Mrs. Trotter gave it to me," Andy answered. "I have been calling on her 3 nights a week for more than a month." "Then you are William Wilkinson?" Jeff asked. "I was," Andy said.
And that's this edition of Learning English Weekend. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining us.